A very warm welcome, everyone, and a huge thank you for being here. I'm Chris Johnson, and this is Pause, Purpose, Possibility. All right, so I'll own it that it might be hard to tell, since I'm generally a fairly even-keeled, mild-mannered, keep-it-chilled kind of fellow. So please just trust me when I tell you that I am bonkers with excitement. I'm telling you that this week's episode is the first of what will be a three-part series featuring my rich and delightful conversation with, wait for it, none other than, did I say bonkers? The renowned author and educator, Parker J. Palmer. I am grateful and honored beyond words by Parker's generosity of spirit and time, every morsel of which begs to be savored. So again, this episode is the first course of a three-course meal, a feast, a bounty of ideas and laughter, mystery and wisdom. As you'll hear shortly, Parker's own introduction of himself is grounded in and reflected of soul rather than ego. So it falls to me here to offer a brief sketch of some of the highlights of his decades-long, globally impactful work. Parker J. Palmer is a writer, speaker, and activist who focuses on issues in education, community, leadership, spirituality, and social change. He is founder and senior partner emeritus of the Center for Courage and Renewal, whose work nurtures deep integrity and relational trust, building the foundation for a more loving, equitable, and healthy world. Through Circle of Trust retreats and other programs rooted in the Courage and Renewal approach, the work of the Center nurtures supportive communities of reflection and practice to help people come alive with a renewed sense of purpose, build trustworthy relationships, and cultivate the courage to rise to today's challenges, making a difference within themselves and their communities. Parker holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California at Berkeley, 13 honorary doctorates, and many, many, many other awards, honors, and distinctions. Parker is the author of 10 books and counting, including several award-winning titles that have sold more than 2 million copies and been translated into 12 languages. They include On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old, Healing the Heart of Democracy, the Courage to Create a Politics Worthy of the Human Spirit, The Heart of Higher Education, which he co-authored with Arthur Zients, A Hidden Wholeness, Let Your Life Speak, The Courage to Teach, The Active Life, To Know as We Are Known, The Company of Strangers, and The Promise of Paradox. A member of the Religious Society of Friends, or the Quakers, Palmer and his wife Sharon live in Madison, Wisconsin. And you can read much more about him and his work on the Center for Courage and Renewal's website, which is courageRenewal.org. There you can also see that Parker has written about the idea of legacy. He says, "My personal legacy? I'd like it to be one of good humor, goodwill, and generosity. I'd like it to be said that we had a lot of laughs, we extended a lot of kindness, and we built an abundant storehouse of heart and soul resources that anyone can draw on." That is exactly what you'll get a taste of as you listen in on my conversation with Parker Palmer. Welcome. Thanks for being here. And enjoy. I can't begin to describe how excited and grateful I am to have with me today my friend. Wow, I can say that aloud. My friend and an inspiration to myself and so many, the author, educator, activist, Parker J. Palmer.
Live and in person from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm here in Minneapolis. We're joined by the wonders of Zoom and so on. But I'm just so thrilled. Welcome, Parker.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's really lovely to be with you. It's been too long since we sat down for a talk.
Well, I'm again grateful that we have this opportunity to do so, and I look for many more in the years to come. So thank you.
Amen.
I have another thing to say about the sort of spirit of how I expect that this conversation will unfold. But before I go any further, for the few folks out there who maybe aren't as familiar as I am with Parker Palmer, it's easy enough to, you know, find you everywhere on the web and doing other podcasts and so on. So many people will already know that they think they know Parker Palmer. But I'd like to start by inviting you to let us know what you would like us to know about who you are. Who do you know yourself to be these days? There's that little lovely little piece that you have shared to the world about the distinction between ego story and soul story that I sometimes have invited other guests to think into as I've invited them to introduce themselves as well. So here's your chance, Parker. What is the story that you would like listeners to know about who you are in the world, in life? Who are you today?
Well, that's a great question. And you know, part of me just wants to say, damned if I know.
That works.
You know, I just think what Merton called the quest for true self, he actually equated that quest with the quest for God. It's never ending. There's an unfolding mystery about true self that I think we spend our lives trying to understand, to locate, to kind of get our arms around in one way or another, or using an image that works better for me, to just walk around the mystery and peer into it and try to catch a glimpse every now and then of what's bubbling in there. I hadn't thought about this until you mentioned it, but this approach we came up with, which we use in Courage and Renewal retreats, the kind of retreats you and I are very familiar with through the work of the Center for Courage and Renewal, which is one of the places where our friendship was forged. Mm-hmm. This device that you referred to, ego story versus soul story, I think those two phrases connote pretty much what they sound like to most people. The ego story is the story with which we try to sell ourselves. It's the story you tell when you're applying for a job or when you're at a cocktail party, wanting to impress somebody. The soul story is the one you live with at 3 a.m, which is that much deeper part of your inner landscape where you are who you are in the most raw and existential way. So I guess what the thought that hadn't occurred to me before, Chris, I'm not quite sure why, but is that today at age 85, the ego story seems largely irrelevant to me. Probably 10 years ago, if you asked me, like, who are you today? I wouldn't have said, damned if I know. with age, I think comes a sinking deeper into the soul story, because that's the story that we all carry with us on this journey called life, right into the mystery of death itself. So I suppose in some ways I'm trailing behind me all the books and the articles and the talks and the retreats where I've explored with the help of others ideas, visions, hopes, possibilities, struggles that are critical to me. Trailing all that behind me, I'm trying to understand what it means to be an old man in the most generative and creative way I know how. I feel like I want to keep at the work that I've done most of my adult life until I'm just no longer physically or mentally capable of doing it. But, you know, what exactly is that work and how can it manifest itself? And what do I need to let go of, and what do I need to give myself to in order to keep doing it authentically, to keep doing it in the face of somewhat dwindling energy, in the face of an inability to multitask the way I used to, et cetera, et cetera. Flying around the country no longer has any appeal for me at all, but for 40 years, that was half my life. I'd spend half my time at home writing and half my time traveling around giving talks and workshops and doing consulting jobs in institutions ranging from universities to religious communities to community organizations, so folks engaged in social change, foundations, medical schools, just, you know, it was a real cross-section of American institutions that I feel very privileged to have come to know and the people in them. But that no longer feels like who I am or why I am. And so the search continues, not only for true self, but how I'm called to manifest it in the world.
I had a privilege in the last 2 weeks or so to have a conversation with a friend and colleague. Part of the conversation was around his experience of eldering and elderhood and a shifting sense of identity and purpose and so on. And one of the images that wove itself into our conversation was that of an elder tree. And he lives on an acreage where he's surrounded by forest. And so he was able to describe encounters he's had with an elder tree, literally in his backyard, a poplar, an old established, couldn't wrap his arms around sort of a poplar. And he said, one thing that's true of that species or of that particular tree and the species is that as they mature, as they grow older and taller, they know how to self-prune. They drop the lower branches that no longer serve them, so that they can put their energy into reaching up and out to the light that is available to them without needing to continue to hang on to or to worry about, as you were putting it, what's trailing behind them. So they just yeah, let the branches go.
It's a lovely image. Thank you for sharing it. I get that, and I totally agree with it. The whole question of what you want to let go of, right, as you age, is important not only for people 85 and beyond, but for people at every age. I think it's just a harder question to see or to embrace when you're younger and you're trying to accumulate experience, knowledge, skill, etc., to say nothing of income and so forth, and you're sort of hanging on to everything. But letting go becomes so important in one's elder years that the question is kind of inescapable. And I like the pruning image very much, because, you know, pruning can hurt, and You have to work your way through the hurt of losing things by which you once identified yourself. I think for a lot of working Americans, this has certainly been true for men. Some women will have told me it's different for women, but certainly for men, my identity is very much wrapped up with what I do and
yes.
how what I do is received in the world. And, you know, when you get to a point where you can no longer do it, or you know you have to let go of big chunks of it, that existential question rears its ugly head. Well, who am I if I'm not doing this stuff? Who am I if I haven't written a new book that's getting great reviews? Who am I if I'm not up in front of audiences that are giving me standing ovations? Who am I if I'm not earning money, et cetera, et cetera? Those are old questions, but they're very real and very sort of existential. I did have an interesting experience in a clearness committee once, which again is part of our courage and renewal work. It's a tool of discernment that we use a lot for ourselves and with other people. And I went into that clearness committee thinking that the questions that I wanted to wrestle with were, what do I want to let go of and what do I want to hang on to?
Yeah.
But by the end of 2.5 hours, 3 hours, I came to understand that the first question remained standing. What do I want to let go of? What do I want to prune off? But the second question, what do I want to hang on to, had morphed into a much better question, which is, what do I want to give myself to? And to me, that's the generative question that you can ask in old age and at really any age. It's a question that's rooted in a sense of abundance, that I still have much to give. What do I want to give myself to, rather than a sense of scarcity, which is, what do I want to hang on to so that I can say, well, I haven't lost everything, which is a very tight, tense, anxious way to be in the world. One more thing while I'm on this little ramble. Some months back, a friend and I were talking, and I think he asked something like, well, what's next on your to-do list? What's next on your work agenda? And I found myself saying something that has actually become important to me. I said, you know, either I don't have anything left to prove, or if I do, I don't have time to prove it. You just toss all of that stuff out the window and then ask yourself, well, what does the field look like now that I've let go of this notion that somehow I've got something to prove to somebody? It's just clear at age 85 that I had my crack at doing that. And, you know, let the results stand for better, for worse, whatever they may be. I just don't have time to prove anything new, if in fact that's required. And I think this is a really important place or point in our self-dialogue or dialogue with friends, then we start laughing at ourselves for the whole pretense. Proving yourself in one way or another was ever what you really ought to have been up to.
Well, at the risk of sounding either obnoxious or like I'm trying to score points or anything, but I can tell folks who are listening that they can find your written version of those three questions. What do I'm hanging on to? What do I want to let go of or prune? And what do I want to give myself to? Is on, I think, around page 26 of On the Brink of Everything. And I know that because I go to it fairly often in different contexts. So for those who want the reminder, that's where you can find it in the book from the guy who actually wrote the book.
I'm honored. Thank you. I've forgotten everything I've written. So it's nice to be reminded every now and then.
Well, it's a pleasure. It occurs to me, Parker, even though we're well into it already, that I've been thinking of our conversation today more as an occasion or a container to invite and to celebrate the joy of our hearts connecting, more of an intimate conversation between friends, as you've alluded, than an interview. So please feel free to, you know, toss things back and forth with me today. Sure. And since I've invoked that word joy right now, maybe let me toss that one out. In addition to what you're letting go of, maybe things you're hanging on to that are so important, what you're giving yourself to, let me just ask, what these days, today, Parker, what brings you joy? What lifts your soul?
What brought me joy when I got up at 6 o'clock this morning was seeing the sun shining through our eastern windows. We haven't seen the sun in Madison, Wisconsin for a couple of weeks, it feels like. Much of a long, damp, cold winter. So the sun brought me joy today. And in a more ongoing sense, for many years in my life, what brings me joy is being in the great outdoors. And the larger the patch of the great outdoors that I'm in, I think the more joy I experience. I was telling you earlier, Chris, that I grew up in a suburb of Chicago that did not lend itself to great outdoor experiences. Although it was possible to walk to the beach on Lake Michigan and, you know, get that kind of oceanic sense from time to time. But my family wasn't really tuned into that kind of thing. I had the good fortune to marry a woman who grew up in Winona, Minnesota, and right there on the Mississippi River, and spent a lot of her young years hiking the bluffs and then camping with her family as they traveled around the Midwest or went out west to visit relatives in California, never staying in a motel, but camping all the way. And so she really introduced me to nature. She specifically introduced me to the boundary waters of northern Minnesota. And that brings me a lot of joy. My work, I mean, I could go on about this, and I'd love to hear whether this is, you know, squares with your experience, but there's something about being in big nature that just puts my life in perspective in a way that I don't really need words to, or that words aren't capable of. I've spent a fair amount of time in the high desert of the Southwest in New Mexico, for example, fair amount of time hiking in the mountains in that part of the world, fair amount of time hiking in the boundary waters. And you look around and you say, this piece of earth, this tree, this rock, this cliff, this body of water, it's seen everything. And the particle life, particle-like concerns I'm carrying with me right now, which seem so heavy, are just weightless in the midst of big nature. And that sort of, you know, that recalibrates my life in a way that I've learned to keep going back to that source when life gets heavy, as it has for me, as it does for most people. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. And I would add to that by saying big nature, yes, in the ways that you described it, and also the quiet, simple, small nature, so to speak. The resilience of a seed, or the life that's in a seed, being able to push its way in spring with melt and freeze dynamics and the mud and the muck that's accumulated, there's somehow still energy or vitality, generativity in that seed to be able to push its way up through to present leaves that reach for the sun and eventually maybe a flower and so on. That's, I in some ways, that's strikes me as small nature, but can still work wonders in the soul.
No, I'm glad you said that. I have that same experience.
Yeah.
I think it took big nature initially to kind of get me there. I wasn't tuned into the natural world, but I was just thinking that we have outside our kitchen window, we have a trifloral maple. I think I've got the name right, trifloral or triflora maple. And in the winter, I really miss the gorgeous, gorgeous leaves on that tree in fall and in the summer. But I've become aware that the way the sun plays on the bark of that leafless tree, in a way that the bark is kind of dappled and rough and angular, and it plays on that with shadow and light in a way that's just absolutely gorgeous. It's all about paying attention, isn't it?
Yes,
to that bark or that seed or whatever it may be.
That evokes, I'm sure I've mentioned it in other episodes of the podcast, that evokes the wondrous little Mary Oliver instructions for living. Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it.
Yeah. I think she once said something like the soul is composed entirely of paying attention. I was also going to say that around your question on joy, the work brings me a lot of joy. And I think the reason I wanted to mention the work, which in my case goes on and on and on. I'm basically a writer, a teacher. I've never been able to settle on quite the right word. Teacher comes pretty close, I think, but writing has been part of how I've been a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lucky in that I'm still physically and mentally able to carry on with my writing, and I do it every day, working at the moment on at the request of my publisher, who's bringing out new editions of four of my books year, 2024. And I'm writing new introductions and related material for all of them. And I have a new book in mind that once I get through this, the necessaries on these new editions, I'll turn to that. But what I wanted to say about that is that writing has always been a real challenge for me. It's always been a struggle. I've known people, I've known good authors who can whip out a couple books a year. I'm nowhere near that. I think the 10 books I've written have on average taken something like four or five years a book, something along those lines. And I've often said a true statement, I'm not a writer, I'm a rewriter. I don't think I've ever published anything that wasn't eighth or 10th draft, because I'm so rarely satisfied with what I get first time through, first time around. And I've had to develop, I hadn't thought of this before either, but I've had to develop a capacity to let things go, because I've had to toss out a lot of pages or a lot that seemed just right at the time, because the deeper I get into a writing project, the more I realize, oh, that doesn't go there. That doesn't work, you know, to reboot, start over, find a different way, in. And I'm aware of this right now because this morning I finally broke through on just the first page and a half of an introduction I'm trying to write for one of my books, for the new edition. I have been busting my head on that introduction. I'm just getting the right doorway into that introduction for probably 3 weeks.
Wow.
And it, you know, one of the things that happens at age 85 is that the demon rises up and says, you've lost it, man. You don't know how to do this anymore. And finally this morning, I had a breakthrough, and I showed it to my wife, Sharon, who's my first line editor and a very, very good editor. And she said, yeah, you've got it. Now you've got it. And I liked that partly because that meant I would get lunch today, you know. You know, Sharon, you know how tough Sharon
is. I do,
So it's interesting to me that I associate joy with a vocation that I've always found kind of crazy making. I'm so grateful that I've pursued it. And obviously, you know, there's this old Greek notion of the daemon, D-A-E-M-O-N, that compels us, that drives us toward certain kind of engagement with ourselves or with the world, especially toward a certain kind of art, perhaps, or artistry. I always felt grateful that I had that daemon demanding that I do this work, but it's hard work for me. It has never come easily. And it brings me a lot of joy when I'm finally able to say, I think this piece is done.
I'm struck by what you and I and folks listening in might recognize as the presence of paradox in what you're saying in a couple different places. So I heard you talk about, and here I'm going to introduce a word that you didn't use, but when you were mentioning the joy that you take in the boundary waters, the wilderness area up on the border between Minnesota and Canada, there's my own experience. Let's just put it this way. My own experience is that there is a vast boundlessness to be experienced in the boundary waters. That strikes me as a bit of a paradox there. And now, what you just said, the relationship, the dance between daemon, D-A-E-M-O-N, in the ancient Greek sense of the word, and you also spoke of the demon that haunts you, that tells you you've lost it.
Right.
So boundlessness in the presence of boundary, the power of daemon in the face of the demons that shackle or hold us back. So let me just toss that observation out and see where you want to run with it.
That's a great catch. I wasn't aware that I had done that.
Okay.
You're absolutely right. And as you may recall, Chris, the very first book I ever wrote, which was truly an accidental book, I didn't set out to write a book. I just ended up having one in my files. It was called The Promise of Paradox.
Yes, yes.
And it was subtitled A Celebration of Contradictions in the Christian Life.
Yeah.
But whatever the content was, this notion of paradox has always been very central to me, and I don't know how to understand my life or anybody's life really without it. And I certainly don't understand how to embrace a spiritual tradition without a powerful capacity to hold paradox, because they're all full of paradoxes. Paradox, for those who may be wondering exactly what I mean by that, a paradox is something that you have to think of in terms of both and rather than either or. So paradox, a true paradox, is a way of holding together experiences that may seem on the surface to be contradictory to one another, but which actually work hand in hand to enhance life or to expand and enlarge life. And I sometimes say to people, you know, we, excuse me, on a regular basis, minute by minute, we engage in a bodily paradox of breathing in and breathing out. And we need, obviously, both sides of that paradox to stay alive. And if I were to say to you, you know what, I've been thinking about it, and I think I'm basically a breathing out kind of guy, so from here on out, that's what I'm going to do. You'd start to worry about me on a number of levels. And so whenever we try to bust paradoxes apart, as in, am I built for community? Absolutely. Am I built for solitude? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there's no way out of this life without embracing one's solitude. And there's no way in this life without embracing one's need for community. If I try to bust that one apart, I die just as much as I would if I, or at least I die spiritually as I would physically if I chose only one part of the breathing cycle. So, yeah, I think those are just the daemon and demon. You're right. Within about 45 seconds, I used both words. And the boundary waters that intrigues me, because part of the struggle in writing, or I think in any art, is that there are, while you are free to exercise your creativity, it's actually demanded that you exercise your creativity. You always do it within a set of limitations or boundaries. The easiest example is painting. You've got a canvas of a certain size to work on, and you've got a medium that will do certain things and won't do other things. Watercolor is a good example. I always marvel at what people can do with watercolor, because that form of paint, that medium, is so tricky to work with. And the same with writing. There are things words are willing to do and other things they're unwilling to do. You can force them, but it comes out clunky and not really worthy of anyone's time. And so you're always dancing in whatever form of creativity you choose to exercise. And it might not be one that's taught in school. It might be the creativity of parenting, or the creativity of friendship, or the creativity of community building, all of which are forms of art that I deeply honor. You're always working within limitations, within boundaries. And yet at the same time, the exercise of creative freedom can expand those boundaries, can create larger space within those boundaries, a space that is habitable by human beings.
So this is where we're going to pause for this week, as we bring to a close part one of my conversation with Parker Palmer. Again, this is Chris Johnson. You're listening to Pause, Purpose, Possibility. I'm so grateful that you're here. Please come back next week for part two of my conversation with Parker. And in the meantime, know how grateful I am that you're here, and that you are who you are, in and for the world.